Good morning. My name is Hattie Dorman, and I'm with the Internal Revenue and participating today as an assister in the Distinguished Women in Government Lecture Series. We are running just a few minutes behind time, and I'm filling in for someone that's not here. However, it is a privilege for me to have an opportunity to present our Distinguished Women in Government for this particular session, who is currently the Assistant Attorney General, Office of Legislative Affairs with the Department of Justice. She brings to us a long history of background, which perhaps I'll just glance at and cite. She's been an associate of the Arnold, Fortis, and Porter, Washington, D.C., a law firm, staff member for the National Conference on Bail and Criminal Justice. And it just goes on and on and on. She says a very distinguished background, and I'm quite sure that we'll be very, very interested in hearing what Patricia McGowan-Wald has to say to us. The logistics will be somewhere maybe 20 or 15 or 20 minutes of presentation, and then we'll open the floor to questions and comments. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. I think when you said that I have a long history, that just means I'm older than most people. As was mentioned, my job currently is in the Justice Department. I'm one of the new appointees. I've only been there about 9 months now. It just seems like 9 years. And I run something called the Office of Legislative Affairs. Very briefly, that handles the relations between the department and Congress. That means that we communicate to Congress the department's legislative policy on a lot of statutes that concern our department, not the entire administration necessarily. And we also work on drafting legislation that goes over to Congress, and then we go up to Congress and we try to see that the legislation passes in the form that we would like to see it pass in. There are replicas of my office in every other major department and a lot of agencies throughout the executive branch. I may be wrong. I think I'm the only woman that heads such an office, and it's probably ironic because I don't bring to it a great deal of legislative experience. I've spent probably the last 20 years working in the legal field, primarily in legal services, poverty law, and in public interest law. I worked in something called the Mental Health Law Project, which did a lot of test litigation on the rights of institutionalized persons, including, which is one area I'd like to touch briefly later on, because one of the things I found out in the course of that was just how discriminated against women are, perhaps the most vulnerable, one of the most vulnerable and disadvantaged group of women are the women who are institutionalized, whether for mental illness, whether for mental retardation, whether girls in juvenile institutions, or women in prison. And that's a field that I think we've really got to make more strides in, because most of those women are just exploited a great deal, and they don't have the political clout perhaps even as much as we do. What I'd like to do today is just go over briefly for the first 15 or 20 minutes some of the things that are going through Congress in the area that I work in that do relate, I think, to the kinds of things that are in the national plan. But before I do that, I'd just like to make a couple of observations about the legislative process, or the congressional process, based again upon a neophyte's experience over the last 9 months. You've all read the statistics about how few women we have in Congress, 18 women in the House of Representatives. They're terrific, but they're still 18 out of 435. None in the Senate. I think when you actually work in the process, that comes home to you. It has a great deal more qualitative impact sometimes than merely looking at the statistics. Because what it really means is that there's no woman on the Senate Judiciary Committee through which an awful lot of the legislation that would affect women's rights will have to pass. It means that there's no woman currently chairing any major committee in either house. And committee chairmen in both houses of Congress exert enormous power. because while they may have only one vote themselves, they have a great deal of say about when legislation comes up, when it's scheduled. The leadership in both houses makes important decisions about when things go to the floor, what things are held over till the next session. There's just an enormous amount of power there that I think I would come away from it, I guess, wanting to take to the hustings and just get a lot more women, and especially in the Senate, if possible, to get in there. One encouraging thing I've seen is that there are, I can't give you comparative statistics because I haven't been around that much, but there are an awful lot of good women assistants up on the Hill, legislative assistants. So what I'm hoping is that since so many women who ultimately and men run for Congress come from the ranks very often of people who have worked in the legislative process, what I hope we're doing is breeding a whole new crop of women, because there just are some excellent women who are doing staff work on the Hill, working on committees and working for representatives and senators. And you see they're very visible, and it's also very nice to deal with most of them. And I think out of their groups, perhaps we'll get a new generation. But again, so much of the plan which we're all looking at will ultimately have to be enacted in some form of legislation. Not all, but an awful lot of it will depend upon the legislative process, the congressional process, and of course you have the same thing happening in your states, in the states, so that the emphasis upon getting more women in committee positions and in both houses of Congress is certainly something I put way up on the top priority. Now let me just go on to a few substantive matters about the kinds of things which in my division, in the Department of Justice, we do have currently in the works that would affect women. And let me start out by introducing someone else who's sitting very quietly here in the first row, who's also from the Department of Justice. And that's Stuart Oniglia, who's head of the, and make sure I've got the name right, I have the concept right, the Justice Department's Task Force on Sex Discrimination. I would like, after I'm through with my spiel, to have her come up and give you a few minutes, because what she's doing is a very exciting thing. And what it is, if I have, is looking through all of the laws and all of the regulations in the federal code and in the federal statute books for two things, not just for superficial or not just for the kind of his, her, or sex discrimination, men, women, but rather looking at the impact of all of those laws and the impact of all of those regulations to see if there is so-called hidden discrimination, institutional sex discrimination. It's an enormous task. She'll tell you a little bit, perhaps, about the deadlines they have and how they're going about it. But I think the deep impact of that, of taking a look at all of our federal laws on the books and all of our regulations and the new ones that come along, and looking at that from the unique perspective of whether how they are going to affect women, is something which I do not believe certainly has ever been done before, and I think it should have an enormous impact and an enormous effect, not only upon changing, if necessary, some of the laws we have on the books today, but upon the way that you look at laws that are coming along. It's something akin to an environmental impact statement, looking at every law and seeing how, in actual practice, you think that law is going to impact women. And that's, I think, a enormously important task, and I'll let her tell you a little bit more about that. Some of the other legislation that we've got going, some of which I'm sure is familiar to you, is obviously we have the law which would attempt to overturn the Gilbert decision, which has now already passed the Senate. And we worked with some of the other departments, the Labor Department, the Justice Department, EOC, et cetera, to work that along. We anticipate that there are going to be problems in the House. It's still down in the subcommittee, and the problems will generally lie in one of those maneuverings in the legislative process. The great fear is that when they attempt to vote it out of committee, Those that oppose it will attempt to tack on various things like abortion, anti-abortion amendments, etc. And the problem in the legislative process is once something becomes a so-called Christmas tree for hanging on all kinds of, whether they're anti-busing or anti-abortion amendments or that sort of thing, then people are apt to throw up their hands and say, well, let's not even move it out of committee because it'll just be too controversial, etc. Now, a lot of people, including a lot of the consortium of women's groups and the departments of the executive, are sincerely working hard to see if we can avoid that. And if we can't get that amendment, which would overturn the Gilbert decision and insist that pregnancy-related disabilities be included in employment plans, we'll make it through without any of those crippling amendments. But it's tight. That's one thing. Another thing, a lot of you have probably read about controversies in the past about the old S-1 and the current S-1437, which is called the son of S-1. And I'm not going to engage here in any disputes about most of the provisions in there. I think that it's an enormously improved bill. There are a few provisions the ACLU and others are still worried about. But I think the thing that may have escaped a lot of people's attention is that as it went through the Senate Judiciary Committee just a few weeks ago, several good things happened by way of amendment. Now, for instance, the bill in its present form does do away with the corroboration requirement for rape. It also has a provision in there which does not allow the background of the complainant in a rape case to be gone into, such as we're all aware of those abuses in the past. And we added an amendment as it went through which took out the former exclusion of spouses from the rape. In other words, in formally it said right in the statute that if it was a spouse, and a spouse is defined as somebody who one is living with, then you couldn't commit the crime of rape, which, of course, is, makes no sense at all, and that's been excluded. So there are some things in there which I think constitute improvements in terms of the criminal laws applied to women. Another thing which was added and which we supported was that the requirement now in there for offenders who, and this, of course, would include women prisoners who are sent through the process for mental examinations or for mental treatment. There's a provision in there that no drugs and no surgery or no electroshock or any of the more intrusive forms of, quote, treatment, that none of those can be performed on someone without their informed consent. And then there's a long list of requirements of what informed consent, both written and oral, and the fact that the written consent cannot be taken for 24 hours after the full explanation has been given in the presence of a witness other than the doctor. As an old mental health lawyer, I know that we fought for several of these informed consent decisions through the courts for several years, and whereas many of us might go even farther than this statute, I think it's a relatively good step in the right direction. Because of all the fuss about the general, more controversial provisions of S-1437, some of these things, in a way it's been good. Some of them have been able to be slipped in without anybody knowing about them. In other ways, I don't think people are aware of them. For any of you legal buffs, I'd suggest, or for your organizations, you might want to take a look at the new federal criminal code as it moves into the House, because the next 6 or 7 months it's going to be going through the House of Representatives. That means there is still time for more amendments. Representative Holtzman, for instance, is on the House subcommittee, which is going to be considering this bill, and I'm sure that she's very receptive to legislative reforms that would be that women's groups would want, or still further modifications which would incorporate into the federal criminal code any of the reforms that are included in the national plan or in other people's programs. But that is going to be happening, and it may be happening fast. I mean, the schedule looks like it will go to the Senate floor at the sometime in late January or early February, an attempt will be made to get it through before the closing of Congress. Now, there's a real opportunity for women's groups working in the House, where they do have 18 women representatives, to get the kind of revision of criminal laws that are espoused both in the plan and in other studies. Now, we have another bill which doesn't look as though it's a woman's rights bill, but I think it's a woman's rights bill because of the work I've done in the past, and that's a bill which would grant to the Justice Department jurisdiction to go into court on behalf of institutionalized persons, which the courts have said they do not have the right to do in order to protect people in institutions from having their constitutional rights violated. It's a very controversial bill because many of the states feel that they don't want the federal government coming in and telling them how to run institutions, and many of the state organizations are against it. However, most of the litigation that I'd done before I took this job had been in the area of the rights of institutionalized persons. I had seen a sufficient amount of violations of the constitutional rights of those people in institutions to realize how important it is to establish the authority of the Justice Department to go in and to protect those people the same way they would protect against outright sex or racial discrimination. Let me tell you why I think it's relevant here. I did a little work, again, when I was working on these cases, and I found such things as that the majority of persons who were residents, when I last looked at the statistics, of mental hospitals were women. The majority of people in old age homes and in nursing homes, just because women outlive men, will tend to be women. And some of the dreadful exploitation, some of the dreadful conditions in which these women had to live in run-down, unregulated nursing homes, so-called residential treatment centers, mental hospitals, etc., were absolutely appalling. The institutional abuses really did have a built-in sexist aspect to them. For instance, generally women were, many of the institutions I knew, were segregated off into special wings. It was supposed to be for their own protection so they wouldn't be abused by male patients or sometimes by the male guards. In fact, there was a lot of sexual exploitation, and I think a lot of the cases will show that, by guards of women in these institutions. Moreover, the fact that they were segregated off meant that they often had no kind of socialization opportunities at all. Another interesting statistic I found was that more lobotomies are performed on women by an enormous ratio than they are by men, on men. There are other built-in problems for institutionalized women. One is that very often, whether you get out of a mental hospital or out of a institution doesn't depend so much on whether you're, quote, sick or whether you're, quote, well, but on whether you can support yourself in the community into which you go. Most in my relatively lengthy experience with mental institutions, unless you really are climbing the walls, you can get out if you have a job and if you can pay your rent and if you haven't absolutely misbehaved very badly in the last month or so. If anybody's been in to see you to find that out. And here again, I think women tend to stay in these institutions much longer than they have to because very often their whole past life or the history has not prepared them so that there's not a job they can go to. Or if they were housewives, they didn't have money that was saved up, so they can't. They don't have a ready amount of money that they can draw on to pay the rent, et cetera. So that, in a way, the kind of economic problems that women have had in the past come back to haunt them at this end of the process because it's much harder to place them out. So many of the cases, and many of which the Justice Department have been involved, seek as relief not just cleaning up the institutions or cleaning up the conditions in there, but rather that the institutions prepare a plan whereby they will keep only those people that need to be there and they will establish alternative facilities, community-based facilities, out in the community. Here again, I think women perhaps the most disadvantaged group of women would benefit from this. Now, obviously, women are not the greatest majority of people in prisons, but they do have some very special problems, and this is something which I think is true, quite frankly, both in the federal system as well as in the state systems. Very often, the woman's prison is somewhere way far away from the community that the woman lives in, and someplace where she's not going to be able to have much communication with her husband and or her friends or her children. And one of the most depressing statistics is the large number, I don't know, somewhere between 50, 60, or 70%, depending upon the particular area you look on, of women in prison do have children. They have young children. Very often those children don't even get to visit them. They don't see them. Very often the fact that they're in prison is used as a trigger for the state authorities to move in and take the children away. So I think that any kind of corrections reform, any kind of prison reform or national so-called standards has to take into account this aspect too. Now, in the Justice Department in recent months, we have set up a task force which is looking at standards throughout the country that would apply or is seeking to bring about national standards for jails and for prisons. I've been going to those task force meetings, and I have been urging upon them that they look at the special problems of women in our own system. The federal system ought to be a leader in this. We ought to, and we're not right now, I'll be very frank with you. But I think that it's very important that we look at the special problems of women offenders in prison and that we begin to do something about it. And when we work with states, either by funding correction programs in states, as some of the LEAA programs do, or sometimes by suing state institutions because they are violating constitutional rights, that this aspect, the particular problems of women in the prisons, have to be built into those. Now, I would think that there's one other area in which we're considering legislation. I've not decided yet whether or not it we will actually introduce it. The only reason we wouldn't introduce it would be for political problems that are attached to it. By political, I mean strategic problems in getting it through Congress. And that would be the extension of the bar against all federally assisted programs not being able to discriminate in race to cover sex. We do have some problems. We do have some programs now to coordinate the expansion of the various statutes. There are about 13 or 14, or perhaps Stuart knows the exact number, of statutes which prohibit sex discrimination in federally assisted programs. And there is an attempt being made now administratively to coordinate that in the Justice Department and to make sure that those are enforced. Now, what I'd like to do is perhaps have Stuart come up and say a few words about her task force and then throw it open to questions from everyone else.
Pat has the concept very well of what the task force is. It was set up last year but never funded. This year in this administration, the task force was funded and the president signed a memorandum on August 26th, Women's Equality Day, at the same time as the march was in Washington, and directed the task force to examine all the laws, regulations, and here's the good part, practices, policies, procedures, anything the federal government does, and examine it for sex discrimination. And so we have taken that mandate very seriously, and so we are doing much more than looking at the laws and the regulations. We're also looking at, well, it's really a policy of the federal government, upward mobility, and does it work? If it doesn't work, that must be a federal policy, and women are not being promoted. Hiring practices, affirmative action programs, any of these internal memoranda, internal policies, whatever the federal government is doing in a policy way, we consider as part of our mandate to examine. So that is what we are doing. The code itself has been put on computer. And so we have done an initial review of the federal code. Now that's just the body of law. We put in about 130 words, and the U.S. Civil Rights Commission did a similar study. We put in a few more words. And bounced out approximately 3,000 sections of the code that made distinctions. Now, these are very obvious ones that are saying, you know, mother, father, sister, brother, male, female, woman, etc. So out came all those that are very easy to see on the surface of it. Many of those, of course, were terminological and may not have any impact at all. Others are such things as pensions for widows of presidents. That's because we've never had a widower of a president, I assume, and so I don't know whether it would cover him. It's important to it is important in that looking at that, though, some courts are interpreting that to mean it means only widows. Other courts are saying, well, naturally they're meant to include both and are extending the statutes. But since courts around the country are going different ways on it, it's very important to have these things changed in the statute. So that has been completed. We have been able to review the statutes that way. We have not been able to get into the regulations because, of course, that's a huge body of area. The letters went out to the from the president and then from the Department of Justice to the executive agencies in the beginning of September, and we have now been meeting, and we have met now with about 70 executive agencies, asking them to set up their contacts and sit down with us and review all of their policies and regs and procedures. And when we look at it, they are doing the review, and we're going with them to it because we're not always sure people are going to know sex discrimination when we see it, because, as Pat says, impact is a very important thing. Social Security, pensions, all kinds of programs of this area. Don't say that, you know, men have this and women don't, but, of course, they impact on women in a detrimental way, and so we are looking at that, too. We expect to be completed in 2 years, at least that's the anticipation, and one of the other areas that we are doing at the same time is why we're working closely with Pat is that many bills, as they go in, we certainly don't want to perpetuate more sex discrimination, so we are reviewing and commenting upon legislation that's introduced and saying, well, there are potential areas of discrimination that are going to be codified. And, of course, the terminological things, we are also interested in that because we're all aware of the psychological impact of always saying he when we really mean he or she. And I want to know that, want you to notice that at the Civil Service Commission and Federal Women's Booth, they're asking for women to come forward and be draftsmen on their booth. So I think there's a lot of work to be done. So. Okay, let me.
I had just three other things, which, needless to say, I forgot to mention, and then I'd love to get your questions. I also had one thought, is that I heard when we were meeting, a few of us in Washington, getting ready for the meeting, other women who were in government. This is perhaps the wrong kind of thing to request, but I'm going to go ahead and say it anyway. And we said, you know, it was amazing to us. There have been great pushes about getting women in government. And I think a lot of us who are in government, I would tell you frankly that I don't think I'd be here except for women's groups who made an enormous push at the time of the transition, at the time to really make sure that the talent pool of women was up front. And I think they put pressure, and they put pressure in the right places, and I think some of the results are showing. But one thing that a lot of us mentioned was that once we got in there, we didn't feel we were really necessarily getting enough pressure. It was almost as though when the first wave came in, we were expected to carry on the good work, et cetera. I think for any of us who were, any of you, a lot of you have been inside the government, and for any of us, you know the enormous obstacles in getting things done inside the government. And I have found, and I've told this not just to women's groups, but to a lot of my public interest friends with whom I had worked outside, you were never more needed than when you have a friendly administration. If you have a hostile administration, there's nothing you can get done. But if you have a friendly administration, that's when you really need to push. So that I think many of us who would like to see a lot more women in government and would like to see it keep going, we really need, if anything, more pressure. Maybe we're not getting enough, and because the pressure sometimes helps us to say, look, you've got to do something. We're getting it from here, there, and everywhere. And so I just pass that along for what it's worth. Another thing that's obviously in the area of justice is judges. We don't have enough women judges. It can make an enormous, a lot of these critical cases that eke their way up, some of them reaching the Supreme Court, some of them being settled at lower rates. Now, what the since this administration did say that there should be created judicial commissions or commissions which would be composed of both lawyers and citizens and would send over to the president, this is in the case of appeals courts, all appeals courts of the United States, but some of them are actually being used on an advisory basis by the congressman for the district courts as well, and that these groups of people would send over, and they should include laymen as well as lawyers, they should send over names to the president. Now, out of that process, and there are women on those commissions, I don't know each and every one, but I do know the ones that I know anything about do have a fair number of women on them. But those commissions should be sending over names to the president. And some already, we're getting a few more women judges, but I hope that, again, there's another lever